and welcome to another edition of Tea with Nettie. Today's guest is Michael Chance, countertenor extraordinaire, although he's sort of not doing so much singing nowadays. He's running Grange Opera and various courses. But we had a very good talk and he reminisced most fondly about the late James Bowman, who we all miss so much. And we just had a rather windy time because we were at the top of the Royal Academy of Music and there's this howling gale going on outside. But I hope it won't distract you too much.
Tea with Nettie.
Michael, hello. Thanks so much for agreeing to do this, being my victim for Tea with Nettie.
Well, Nettie, it's been, we've had so many conversations over the years, and so a treat to have one of them recorded, I have to say.
Ooh, well, we shall see. I know you're going to make me laugh. I can feel this coming. Anyway, here you are, and more recently, the most times I've seen you has been in connection with The Grange, which you're running the opera at The Grange, and I thought we could start there and work backwards to what led you to that point, if you'd like to do that.
Just happenstance, as the Americans call it. Just happened to be in the right place at the right time, if you like. Well, I don't know. I call it the right time. I don't. Other people may call it the wrong time, but it was a curious situation, as so often happens in the performing arts, particularly in music, is that a situation developed which needed to be filled, and it developed quite spectacularly, sort of with difficulty and with a huge degree of tension. And they, at The Grange, as you probably know, is owned by a family. It's not dissimilar to Glyndebourne in many ways in the relationship, yes, with the Christie's family. And they suddenly were left with a beautiful opera house and absolutely nothing to put in it. Mm. At all. Mm-hmm. So I happened to know somebody who'd joined the family recently and had known her for many, many years. So just through a personal connection, they thought, well, let's talk to me, Michael, because he's been doing, you know, in this profession for very, very many years, and he might come up with some ideas of what we can possibly do to start a new festival and use this amazing theatre in this beautiful place. So I didn't know anything about the history or anything, really, anything to do with The Grange. So I had a lot of learning to do about the difficulties they'd had, which I won't go into here, because they're a little bit controversial. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, well, actually, you've got two very good things going for you here. You've got a beautiful theatre and a beautiful place, a Willicott Theatre, and you've got a ready-made audience in the sense that people had been going to performances there for 18 years, and they weren't likely to stop. We'd had the problem of how to get access to them because we couldn't have any access to a database or names and addresses or anything. So we had to start absolutely completely from scratch with nothing. Actually, we started with an empty theatre because all the seats and most of the equipment had been taken away, and indeed some of the flooring and many of the light bulbs. But we didn't have a bank account or a name or a charity number or a database or anything or an office. So the first few months of the Grange Festival were just me on a mobile phone, wow, putting the whole thing together. And actually, I was singing in an opera then in Holland. I was invited to sing the part of an extremely unpleasant medieval pope in a touring production of an opera called Marieken, and I had to sing my big scene in medieval Dutch, which I've never had to do before. So I was coping with that at the same time as putting together a whole season of an opera and sending in emails and ringing around people I knew in the profession saying, will you come and sing in this new festival? I don't have any money to pay you or anything, but will you come? And nobody said no, not one person.
Well, that is a testament to you and the force of your personality.
Well, you're very kind, but it's developed from, I mean, it was always going to be a vaguely professional operation, and we did get our bank account, we did get our charity number, and an awful lot of people gave a lot of money to re-equip the theatre with seating, with lighting, with all the things that it had been stripped of, and there we are now. And we've just we started in first festival in 2017, and here we are in 2023, and we've done well, 6.5 festivals, because we actually managed to do one in the COVID year 2020, which is all outside, extremely socially distanced, but we managed to put something on.
Absolutely fantastic. And there's so much goodwill around it. And because you are so well known and so loved amongst your colleagues as well as amongst the public, that must have done so much to help things actually.
Well, you're very nice to say that. Yes, and I think, I mean, you know, you and I are roughly the same sort of generation, and we've been around a long time. And we've made a lot of connections, mostly, hopefully, quite good ones. Yeah. And that people, it is that sort of a profession. It actually, people are in general incredibly positive, incredibly friendly. When you've worked together at an intense level in a performance or two or many, people don't forget it. And actually, you have a shared bond. And it really does work like that. Actually.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And particularly because it was in such dire straits, but the potential was so enormous. That's absolutely fantastic. What a wonderful story. And you've done some amazing things there, haven't you?
Yeah, we've done. Gosh, in our programme this summer, I thought we'd put a list of everything we've done to date. And we've done sort of 6 or 7 different sort of productions, mostly operatic, but not all, every year. So that's nearly 50 different productions we've done in, or certainly 40 in that time,
that's
including concerts, and musical theatre we've done a few times, and other things off away. We even did an opera by Granados called Goyescas, which means Little Goyas, in the Wallace Collection, big room in the Wallace Collection, where they were having a Goya exhibition on. Things like that we've done.
Fantastic, really creative. Yeah. Wonderful. Oh, well, hats off to you for making
it
work. And you combine that, well, that's seasonal, but you combine it with teaching, and presumably you're still performing.
No, I'm not performing.
Not at all.
It's very hard.
I heard you in the corridor sort of making countertenorish noises.
Well, you can call that performing if you like.
Oh, well, that was because you'd lost your coffee, wasn't it?
It's a difficult one. If you're of the mindset that you actually have to make it work and treat it seriously and You look after yourself, and it's all about muscles. Singing is all about muscles. I suspect playing stringed instruments is really all about muscles as well. And at a certain you're an athlete, and if you reach a certain stage and you don't keep it going on a regular basis, you know, daily or weekly, the voice, you know, it becomes in a state where you don't have the sort of control and ease of production which you are used to, and it's not much fun. And actually, to be perfectly honest, having done it for nearly 40 years, waking up in the morning thinking, oh God, is it going to work today? Can I sing a Barmadik, or can I sing another thing? You can't really do it justice. You think, leave it, hand over to the next generation. And I think handing over to the next generation is actually something I feel very, very strongly about.
Well, yes, and for you it's particularly wonderful because your son has sort of taken up where you started, really, hasn't he?
Against all advice.
Well, I've heard him, he sounds wonderful.
And well, you're very kind. Yes, no, I mean, he's come at it from a slightly different angle. I mean, he went to university, he did a degree not in music, he was a choral scholar at New College and had a fantastic time there. In fact, he had far too good a time and never really sang properly in the choir until his last year. Anyway, that's another story. But he loves it. He loves the business of what singing and collaborating and making music at a good level is all about. And that's what he does. He's got no particular. He's realistic about it. You know, we're in a mostly contracting profession. Opportunities are not what they used to be, and you have to be, you know, on your toes and extremely good, and you have to be very good at presenting yourself to the outside world these days as a performer if you're going to get noticed. So all of these things are not for everybody, and at the moment they are for him, but he's under no illusions that they will necessarily be for him forever. But I think he's thinking he'll have a good 10 or 15 years and see how it goes. And if you've got that state of mind, perhaps it'll be even better that, I think.
Yes. And you teach. I mean, do you teach in Holland as well as here?
I do. I've been teaching in the conservatory in The Hague for 20 years, actually, or 22 years now, one to one. But I haven't done that for quite a few years now. So what I do is actually, you're talking to me on a morning in the Royal Academy of Music, where last night I came back from Holland, having auditioned about 30 or 33 singers for an operatic production, and that's what I do in the conservatory every year. We do an opera from scratch, an early opera.
Yes.
We put it all together in a week. We do two performances. You know, it's fully staged, lit, everything. And you know, you think, how on earth we can do that? Well, we managed somehow. And yesterday I was auditioning them, the students in The Hague, mostly on the early music course, but not exclusively. And then I go back in early December, and we have 3 or 4 days of intense music rehearsal, and then they're sent away, and they spend the Christmas holidays learning their part, and they come back in January, you know, with it all committed to memory, and then we put it together. And we've done some quite audacious things. It's, you know, if you're fully focused in a whole group. So we use The Hague's a very good place because it's got it's big and it's got one of the biggest early music departments in the world, if not the biggest.
Yes.
So you can put together an ensemble, whether it be an orchestra or a continuo group, or whether it is of very good players who are very committed quite easily.
Yes, and it's long been a centre for a mecca for early music specialists, hasn't it?
Yeah.
It's one of the oldest established ones.
Yeah.
And then I know that you're involved in a summer course in Siena, and I wonder if any of your students from... Well, are you?
Yes,
I got
no,
right?
We'd had one this year. That's a sort of... that's grown up over the years. I actually started my wife's family home in Greece on a Greek island. We did that for 10 years, and I did that initially with the Vowel Consort Fretwork.
Oh, yes.
And we used to go there, and they used to have incredibly keen amateur viol players, usually from Holland, getting together, playing Laws, consort music and things like that. And I had about 10 or 15 singers, and we used to combine, and that worked quite well. And then it became just a singing course, and then I had a break, and then through another connection, because I had been teaching in a school near Florence for many years, La Scuola di Musica in Fiesole, it's called, just above Florence, which is an independent music school with a fantastic youth orchestra. And I'd been doing a sort of Barocchi course there for about 5-6 years, and then the Siena thing grew out of that. So now we have about 10, 15, 20 students who literally come all from all over the world. Wow. We spend 10 days in Siena, and there are several things about it. Siena is a very extraordinary city. It has an incredibly rich community and civic spirit, and nothing much has changed in Siena, you could say, and they say, for about 800 years, the way it organises itself. And we get access through connections to incredible rooms and buildings and performing spaces which are not normally available to the public, and we can do performances there. Which is great. And actually, the last performance, just 2 weeks ago, we finished, we had 12 singers, and we did a room-to-room promenade recital in the Pinacoteca Nazionale, which was the National Gallery.
Oh, how wonderful.
And we started at the top, and we did singers singing next to famous Duccio altar pieces and things like that, and then moving down. And there's a fantastic portrait of Queen Elizabeth I holding a sieve, which is a symbol of virginity, and we had somebody singing a lute song next to that.
Hang on, a sieve is a symbol of virginity.
Virginity, yes.
How does that work?
Well, we could go into it if you like.
Yes, I'd like you to.
It's a complicated iconography.
Sieve?
Actually, I think she looks, in this picture, she's wearing black and she's got red hair. She looks much more like Mary Queen of Scots, but they think it's with Queen Elizabeth
I. And was it an Italian artist?
Yeah. Yeah, well, there are lots of Italian artists and others.
Well,
and
I know, but
in London at the time.
Yes, that's amazing.
We do things like that, and that's good fun. So yeah, the Siena course, and it's quite a rich mix, but it's a very good one. But it goes back, Nettie, to what we were saying earlier about actually how handing over to the next generation, encouraging them, and giving them helping them with that expertise, but also giving them platform to perform and to collaborate and to make music is incredibly important, especially at a time when opportunities are coming less frequent for them, I think.
Yeah, absolutely true. Wow, yes, this is all very serious, isn't it? Well, I think we need a bit of levity now. So thinking back to when I first met you, I think you were singing in the Monteverdi Choir, or certainly performing
in the early 80s.
And this bouncy, screechy person in beautiful knitted tank tops suddenly appeared.
I've never been called that before. That's very nice.
Really? What, bouncy or screechy?
Bouncy and screechy in beautifully knitted tank tops. I think that could go on some...
No, but we used to have a lot of fun on tour.
We did.
But we won't talk about that incident. I was looking back through some old photos the other day, and there were some photos. Was it Perugia, or there was a medieval hilltop
near
town?
Lyon.
Near Lyon. Wasn't it?
Is that the time where we were doing...
I get muddled up.
Tamerlano, Handel Opera.
I think we were.
That's right. We were all
very... doing Tamerlano, and you had a costume that looked like Superman, I seem to remember.
Oh, really?
Didn't
There's
she?
Also
was
another
of...
scene where Derek Lee Regan, who's playing Tamerlano, and I, the two countertenors, were very, very scantily dressed, lying on marble slabs,
being
massaged by even more scantily dressed young French, Turkish bath... inhabitants. It was that sort of a production, but
it was a strange production. I do remember that Nigel Robson, I call it Badger Set because that's where I remember who he was, and he was suspended in some sort of
cage. Well, he was imprisoned. That's right.
Yes. So he was sort of singing while sort of gently swinging from the ceiling.
That image was terrific, and he did it brilliantly.
He did do it brilliantly.
It was a symbol of noble authority and unwillingness to compromise. He did not want to accede to the power of his conqueror, Tamburlaine the Great, who wanted to ask for Bayazets or Bajazets approval that he marry his daughter, and he said, absolutely not. And actually, it's incredibly moving end. We just did it at the Grange.
Oh, did you? Right.
Yeah, last year. And it was terrific.
I remember Nancy Argenta was...
Yes, she was.
Well, that was... But I remember it was a lot of fun doing that. I do remember that. But we used to have great outings, didn't we?
Food played a part, I think.
Food
plays a part often with the musicians on tour. I've always found that, musicians, singers, everything else, if you promise to feed them well, they'll do anything for you.
That's true. I mean, the other thing is, one of the more embarrassing sides, certainly from the point of view of an orchestra and possibly a choir as well, if you're invited to one of these receptions afterwards, they usually sort of give you lots of rather sweet fizz, and you have to sort of stand there through speeches in lots of languages. So when you're allowed at the food, the trotters in the trough, the orchestra's there immediately, and it goes through it in about sort of 2 minutes flat.
It's gone on about, exactly right.
Yep. It's terrible. The singers like that. I can't believe they're quite...
Well, but if you've done a performance, you've used a lot of energy.
You have.
And if you're a string player and you've played for 3 hours of a Handel opera, you never stop.
You never stop. And if you're a singer, you probably can't eat that much before you sing, can you?
Actually, singing before a performance is quite a refined art.
Singing before a performance, or even eating before a...
Eating before singing performance. Singing before an eating performance is all of that.
Singing for your supper, even.
No, when you get older, you think, Christ, when's the best time to eat? You've got a 3 or 4 hour performance ahead of you.
Yeah.
And how do you pace it? And how do you organise your intake? And then there's another thing I just want to raise of... You finish at 10 or 11. If you're in Spain, it could be midnight or 1 in the morning,
true,
which I've done. I remember doing Julius Caesar at Oviedo in the north of Spain. We didn't finish till well after midnight. And then we went out to dinner. We didn't get to bed till 5 a.m.
Goodness.
This is Spain. That wreaks havoc on your vocal muscles.
And particularly if you've got a flight the next day somewhere.
All of that, yes, exactly. So the whole business of flying around, performing, rehearsing, air conditioning, eating, sleeping, bad hotel rooms, uncomfortable beds, all of these things play a part in the life of a singer.
And also your memory, having to memorise so much as well, and if you've got the sort of director that keeps changing your moves.
Exactly. Well, remembering... trying to commit a whole operatic role to memory. Once you've done it, it's sort of there.
Yes.
But it does take time.
I can imagine that.
And actually, what are you supposed to think about? What's the quickest way to committing it to memory? Mm. It's all about the thought processes. What your thought is leading to the next thought and the next thought, which I think is a really good way of teaching singing in general, actually. Mm. And that's how to do it, rather than sort of trying to memorise the sounds of words in languages you don't particularly well understand, which is so hard.
It must be.
Well, you end up with weird mnemonics once.
Yes.
I remember before I was a singer, we had a group out of university, and we used to do sort of Sibelius songs in Finnish and things else, and of course didn't understand a word of Finnish. But we all created ridiculous word associations, usually around sport or something like that. So Bertie Mu became Bertie Me, who was a football manager at the time, things like that.
It's like me and Badgerset.
That's exactly the same as Badgerset. That's right.
Oh, that's really funny. And I was talking to Tim Mead the other day, and he was saying how his warm-up routine got completely destroyed when he was doing Midsummer Night's Dream, which of course you had done famously, because of the costume and makeup taking so long.
It's a long call, I seem to remember. That the sticking up ears, the wig,
yes,
all of that stuff,
and the heaviness
is a good hour.
He
I'd
said
say.
That, but he also said that they put him in your costume, so he felt really sort of very happy to be in your costume.
That presumably probably means you're roughly the same size.
Yes, exactly. He was sort of wondering, funny. Yeah. Oh, maybe they trawl looking for people of the same size.
Well, funny enough, you should say that. Glyndebourne asked me to do it in 1988 or 89, and I didn't have to audition singing, but what I had to do is present myself to the director of the show, Peter Hall, and I had to go to the National Theatre, where he was running the National Theatre,
yes.
You know, incredibly busy, and I just needed to show myself and have a quick chat to him, and he was only interested in one thing, really, how tall I was. That costume, which actually I'd taken over from James Bowman, and he was roughly the same shape as me, but I had a new costume, which is very nice, and then Tim has done it twice, I did it twice, and he's done it twice. And it's got my name written in his name tag at the back, which
and he's very happy about that.
Well, that's right. I'm very thrilled, very honoured, yes. In fact.
But I suppose how he feels about you must have been how you felt about James Bowman, the dear,
yes,
late James Bowman.
James, yes.
Because you and he had such a connection, didn't you?
Well, first of all, he was incredibly generous towards me, I have to say. He sort of said, when I'd started doing opera and getting a few offers and everything, I remember him saying publicly, right, over to Michael now. Right, he can do all these things that I've been doing. In a very generous and rather public and extraordinary way. And I felt very included. And he wasn't, I mean, he was still singing a lot. In fact, we used to sing a lot together. Mm. We did duet concerts. And we did a big tour around France with Charles Brett of the Les Trois Outre-Contre.
Really?
Which is a bit ridiculous, really.
How wonderful.
It's a sort of rather pathetic attempt to be like the three tenors. But it worked, we did. But we did that, I don't know, 15 or 20 concerts around France, I think, which is good fun.
That must have been such good fun. And I should imagine James was outrageous. I mean, Charles had a great sense of humour, but James...
Well, all had a great sense of humour. James used to...
The thermostat, you know, went missing or faulty sometimes.
We used to do, you know, start with a duet or something. Yes. Then he might do one solo, and then he'd whisper and say, over to you, I'm off now. And you just walk off the stage and go to something else.
Really?
Who knows where he went?
Oh, my
goodness.
Came back
half an hour later.
Oh, how funny.
Yeah, he was good fun. He was brilliant. Yes. He's a wonderful, relaxed, spontaneous performer. And a lot of people could learn from that approach, I think. Mm. But, you know, very bright as well.
And a wonderful connection with the audience.
Yeah, that's right.
A lot of charisma.
Yeah.
And what I associate both of you with the words and the intent was so absolutely clear.
Oh, well,
clear.
Thank you. Yes, well, I think that is crucial. And actually, if you enjoy language, then as a singer, you have a fantastic time because there's such a range of uses of language and ways of communicating them. And that's, you know, if you're singing a song by Henry Purcell, you know, it's as much about the language as anything else.
Yes. And of course, you were a chorister at King's, weren't you?
I wasn't a chorister.
Weren't a chorister?
No,
sorry,
I didn't do the cold chorister
wrong.
Thing. I nearly did, but I didn't. No, I was a choral scholar, which means...
Oh, you're a choral scholar
there,
okay. When
I was an undergraduate at a university, I sang for 3 years in the choir, which is pretty much a semi-full-time job, really.
And how did that prepare you? Well, it must have helped with preparing for Purcell, but did you consider that was a really good preparation for what you ended up doing?
Well, funnily enough, I did a lot of putting things together at university, organising concerts and tours and operas and all that sort of stuff. I didn't ever think I'd be a singer. And in fact, finishing as an undergraduate, I had two interviews, one with EMI Records, classical, and one with an agency called Ibsen Tillett. Neither of them led anywhere, thank goodness. Yeah. But that was my thought. First thought was actually to go into the management side of things.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So, well, that's amazing. So all your talents have come together to
I've done help at the grain. But I mean, you know, it's. I suppose I have an instinct of sort of putting things together and trying to connections between people and putting them together.
Yes, yeah. And you read English, didn't you?
Yes,
uni. And yes,
which sort of
you
means,
are literate.
Means nothing or anything nothing. Or whatever you want to make of it.
But like, you didn't like read music.
Humanities.
I suppose I was.
No, I didn't read music.
You didn't read music.
No.
Yes, and actually, I know a lot of very talented musicians who started off on the music course and just it wasn't.
No.
It ended up just
it's
not being
dry.
Practical enough for them.
At the ancient universities, reading music is a very dry occupation.
Yes. Imagine. It's an incredible howling wind up here, isn't it? There's a combination of wind and creaking and the odd siren. It sort of feels like being in a lighthouse to me.
We are quite
high up in the building. Yes.
Well, it's an ancient Victorian building. So.
Do you come from a family of musicians? I mean, your parents or siblings?
We had music in the house. We used to, not like your family, if I may say so, which is a remarkable musical family. There was music around. My brother was a chorister at St George's Windsor. See, he did all that whole thing. My father used to play jazz piano at home and used to play tenor sax. And used to play things like Alexander Nach music on a tenor sax.
Oh, how wonderful! Oh, my goodness!
As well as other things.
Idea.
I mean, it was, you know, it was just a sort of slightly rumbustious, not at all professional.
But it was very much part of everyday life.
Yes.
That's lovely. Oh, that's great. So they must have been really proud when you started being a...
Well, my mother died when I was very young, so she never... I was, 13. And my father... He was a bit anxious about it because he knew the precariousness of a life as a freelance singer on the road, which, you know, it could be a feast or famine, which it often is for singers. You get a lot of work and then nothing for months on end, and very hard to cope with that. But he gave me one extraordinary piece of advice. We were a very sporty family and did a lot of sporting, and he said, well, I suspect you'll be going on tour, and I suspect you'll have a lot of time in your hands, so take a set of golf clubs wherever you go, which is his advice to being a professional musician, which is not a bad piece of advice, actually.
It's true. Loads of musicians, yes. I can think
Matthew
golf. Rose and Robin Ticciardi.
Exactly.
Yes, loads of them
remember
do, don't they?
Bryn, Bryn Terfelin in Salzburg many years ago. He lent me his bicycle as we were there at the same time, and he was off to golf course all the time.
Oh, really? So you all get very good swings. Oh, that's brilliant. I mean, have you ever been in a very competitive situation, golf-wise, with someone that you had to be very good friends with on stage?
You and I spent 10 days together in Aldborough in 1980-something, recording the Matthew Passion.
Oh, yes, we did, didn't we?
And there
we?
Were
yes.
lots of gaps when we weren't needed.
And lots of golf.
And quite a lot of us were quite sporty, so we would do a quick 9 holes and then race to the Maltings and record another bit of the Matthew Passion. I remember turning up at the Maltings and they said, right, you're on, Michael, and I'd just been out of, you know, not for 3 hours on a, you know, hitting a ball around, hair everywhere, everything else, and said, right, credit in, got to record a Barmadich now. So we recorded it in 2 takes and then back to the golf course.
Because you probably felt so resentful at being hauled in from the golf course anyway.
No,
Barmadich was a sort of annoying little thing to record in the middle.
It was written down on a schedule somewhere. I think it was a little bit of notice.
Yes.
But actually, it was a memorable time. We were there all
time. It was a wonderful time,
the sort of thing
wasn't
which you couldn't happen now because no record company's got the money to pay for it. But we had 10 days in Suffolk.
We did.
You know, recording this phenomenal music in this amazing hall.
It was phenomenal in Snape. And do you remember they had to pay, they had to have some agreement with the RAF so that they wouldn't allow their fighter jets to do their practice. And it lasted until the very last morning of the last day. And then they would let rip and they had a lot of trouble.
RAF Bentwaters. I think there was a story of Popular Portugal that Anne Monoyos, who was the soprano solo, was singing. And the last day they left for the quietest aria, which is Ausleben.
Yes.
With solo flute
that's
and two oboes to catch
exactly.
and continue.
That's what
and that
I remember.
It. And there was just ceaseless roar from dawn of aeroplane, military aeroplane again flying over. Actually, I think it was an American base. So I think there was a story that at one moment, Anne, as an American citizen, I think she's American, got on and said, as an American citizen, could I ask you just to give us an hour of relief And the colonel of the base, yeah. Lady, war waits for no man.
Oh, no.
Is the response.
Oh, no.
And this is the most loving, the most intimate, the most touching aria of all in the Matthew Passion. The sort of slight contrast there, I think.
A slight contrast, yes. Oh, my goodness. Great. Wow. And, yes, I do remember that really well. Oh, we were lucky, weren't we? Except that I think I was going backwards and forwards recording with Andrew Parrott and the Taverner Players, recording The Messiah. At the same time.
Wow.
So
three
or four of us were sort of going backwards.
Amazing.
But, you know, in those days, there were so many
recording sessions.
You know,
that, in the 80s, those of us who were active at that time were recording so much.
Yes.
That's another thing where we just doesn't happen now.
It was just, we took it for granted.
We took it for granted. And I think it was a unique period, a unique 10, 15, possibly 20 years in the history of music, that so much was recorded so quickly and so with new technology.
Yes.
Some of it has stood the test of time, but not necessarily all of it, I have to say.
Not necessarily all of it. It's quite scary to think that today's students use those recordings to sort of learn
pieces. They still do. It must be very ancient for them, like, 30 years ago.
I think some of them are, yeah. I mean, we started off on vinyl, didn't we?
And we did. We certainly did.
Redo everything else.
That really dates us. Let's not go there.
No. All right, we won't go there. But, I'm aware I don't want to hold you up too much.
No, carry on until we're thrown out.
Yes, I shouldn't think the gentleman who's kind enough to let us use this room is going to dare throw the great Michael Chance out.
Oh, he would. Anyway. We're in the Royal Academy of Music here, anything can happen here.
Well, that's true. So you still do a lot of golf.
I don't do any golf, I have to say.
Do you not? I was just thinking how busy you must be, just telling me about teaching in two places, running the Grange, running the Italian thing.
Yeah, it is busy.
Busy.
That the Grange is a summer festival, and of course it is a summer festival, but it requires, I have a team of 12 or 13 working full-time for it.
Of course, yes.
And we do quite a lot outside, particularly in schools and education, which I think is
a
really important part of what we do.
Absolutely. And OAE is totally.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know all about that.
Yeah.
And, but at a time when, I think music came off the national curriculum 40 years ago. So
was
we're a generation in the third, if you'd call it a generation 30 years after that. So so many people of our children's or even, further generation have no really awareness of what live music making in a school or in a group is really all about. A lot of people do, of course, but many, many, many fewer than used to be the case 40 years ago.
It's so sad. Well, OAE, just at the moment, it's got this really exciting project with a very famous choreographer called Kim Brandstrup doing hip-hop to the Bach Double Concerto.
Oh, fantastic.
And the kids really into it.
Of course they do.
They absolutely love it. It's such a wonderful way of linking to find something that a student is passionate about and somehow bind it to classical music to give
depth. Who do music and have done it for a long time know very well the benefits which actually being involved in making music at whatever level can bring you.
Yes.
And I see some very fundamental positives with young people, from the age of 5 or 6 onwards. Just their ability, number one, their self-confidence. Number two, their ability to communicate in a group. And number three, their ability to start imagining and use that imagination in order to be creative. If you use music or dance or literature or theatre or anything which involves collaborating and creating something out of nothing, which is what sort of you do with music, then it's going to give you that confidence.
That's a really great way to end. And thank you so much for sparing the time, Michael. That's absolutely brilliant.
Well, I've enjoyed
it. Lovely to find out more about you.
Well, thank you. It's been great to touch base. Thank you.